Welcome to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and advanced physics students from Roaring Fork Valley High Schools. The students spend a week working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the distinguished physicists who are here. I'm Patty Fox, and I'm hosting today's program, which was recorded during the teen summer program at the Aspen Center for Physics. With me today are Matt Popish from Aspen High School and Will Kaufman from Glenwood Springs High School. They will be interviewing David Campbell, professor of physics at Boston University. David Campbell is a well-known scholar and theoretical physicist who specializes in nonlinear phenomena and condensed matter physics. He received the American Physical Society's 2010 Lilienfeld Prize, awarded for, quote, pioneering new approaches to the study of complex systems and for communicating the excitement of this new field to diverse audiences. David served as the Boston University Provost for more than 5 years, but stepped down in 2011 to return to teaching and research. He came to BU in fall of 2000 after 8 years as a professor and head of the Department of Physics at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Previously, he was the director of the Center for Nonlinear Studies at Los Alamos National Laboratory, which he had joined in 1974 as the first J. Robert Oppenheimer Fellow. He earned a BA in Chemistry and Physics from Harvard University and a PhD in Theoretical Physics and Applied Mathematics from Cambridge University. An illustrious guest today on Radio Physics. Welcome, and we'll begin with Matt.
What sparked your interest in physics, and why did you want to become a physicist?
Boy, that goes back a long way. I think I was trying to think about it, and honestly, I think I heard the word astrophysicist when I was just about old enough to pronounce it correctly. And somehow that concept stuck, and that, I think, was the first time I thought about it.
When you first went into the sciences, did you actually go in with the intention of becoming an astrophysicist?
By the time I was taking serious courses in high school and then in college, I wasn't specifically looking at astrophysics. In fact, as an undergraduate, I majored in chemistry and physics at Harvard, and was my experimental work at that time was in chemistry. So it wasn't clear I was going to go on in physics at that stage.
So at what point really changed your mind to focus on physics?
I think when I went to Cambridge, where I ended up getting my PhD, it was clear to me that I was more interested in the theoretical and mathematical aspects of a subject, and that the physics seemed to offer a richer set of theory questions than chemistry. I apologize to my chemistry friends for saying that, but it seemed to be a more general approach to the world.
Could you explain or describe some of your recent work with two-dimensional materials such as graphene?
Okay, well, first let me let the radio audience know what graphene is. It is actually a single atomic layer of carbon, and they can make graphene sheets as big as a tablecloth, quite remarkably. If you remember any of your high school chemistry, you may remember that benzene famously is a hexagonal ring of carbon with hydrogen on the ends of the carbon. But graphene is those hexagons all together tessellating the plane. So it's a little bit off, but if you look at the floor of some men's rooms, I assume it's the same in women's rooms, they have these hexagonal tile patterns, and they completely tessellate, that is, cover the plane. So graphene is a material that can be made in a single atomic layer and is extremely interesting to study. Amusingly, the first real isolation of graphene was done by what's called the Scotch tape method, where you take a piece of graphite, which is, by the way, pencil lead. Pencil lead is not lead at all. It's graphite. And you put it back and forth between bits of Scotch tape, opening and closing it, and eventually you will get to a single layer of graphene.
Have you yourself ever done this?
I have done it. Great question. I give a public talk, or a talk actually sometimes to science students, and I have a demonstration where they are allowed to do that. The trick is, you don't know that you've actually made the graphene, because a single atomic layer, you can't see with the naked eye. In fact, the experimentalists who did the work, Geim and Novoselov, were a bit lucky because they put the graphene on a particular substrate, silicon dioxide, which was just such that the interference patterns they could see allowed them to identify the graphene very easily. So it was, as usual, a bit of luck as well as good science.
What have you been working on during your time at the Aspen Institute?
Aspen Center for Physics, yeah. I've talked to several people, had some very interesting conversations. I just had one with a longtime friend and colleague, Herbie Levine, who is working on cancer. I'm working on, as I said, these two-dimensional materials. But we found a connection the following sense. One of the things I'm working on now in two-dimensional materials is what happens if you take those materials and make cuts in them in something that's called kirigami. It's a Japanese art form. I don't have time visually, it's hard to explain on the radio, but anyone who's interested should look up in Google kirigami. And you can make those cuts in these two-dimensional materials. Herbie was telling me about someone in biology who makes patterns of cells with different characteristics that are flat and two-dimensional, but when you stretch them, they can fold into different shapes. And that's exactly what our graphene kirigami does. So the same concept of straining something and making it into a shape exists both for the biology and for the physics. I also talked it gets more technical, but to Stefan Kerrein, who was here, about something called many-body localization. I don't think I'll try to go into detail on that, but it's one of the very hot topics, and it's related to some work that I've been doing on another problem called the Fermi-Pasta-Ulam problem, which is about, basically, it's about whether systems go to thermal equilibrium or not, whether everything goes to thermal equilibrium. And the answer is some systems don't, and we're not quite sure why.
So with the kirigami technique and just all the different kinds of cuts and shapes that you can do with graphene, how does that affect the practical applications and just the actual properties of the substance?
So what happens when you stretch a piece of kirigami is the sheet goes out of the plane, moves into different structures. That's how you can make different patterns and different, literally build boxes out of it. That affects the way electrons move in the system, and you can make various electronic devices by controlling and control their properties by the amount of strain you put on. Graphene itself is what is called a semi-metal, which means that there is no gap in the electronic structure. Most of the things we use in our electronics are semiconductors, which have a gap. And it's the ability to excite things across the gap that makes the control of the semiconductors. There are other two-dimensional materials, which I and many others have studied, molybdenum disulfide, and things that go by the name of transition metal dichalcogenides. You have to look that one up, too. But there's a very large number of these materials that you can literally peel off in layers and get two-dimensional materials from them.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Could you talk a little bit about your work with intrinsic localized modes?
Okay, so these are all things that are getting somewhat technical, but for a long time, it was thought that if you had a lattice, in fact, it's the basis of solid state, a lattice of ions, and the electrons moved in that lattice, that they would move in what are called bands. They would move as if they were free. It's a remarkable result called Bloch's theorem, and is the basis for all of solid state physics. It turns out in certain lattices, if you have nonlinearity as well as lattice spacing, you can have excitations which are rigorously localized on the lattice, and they stay localized. Sometimes they can be made to move, sometimes not. And those are what are called intrinsically localized modes. Another way of getting localized modes in a lattice is if you have a defect. If the lattice isn't perfect, then if there's a defect, the electrons tend to collect there. That's I would call extrinsic localization. It goes by the name also of Anderson localization, after Phil Anderson, who first discovered it. But in nonlinear lattices, you can have the ability to have localization even without any defects, just because of nonlinearity. The intuition is sort of, because the system is nonlinear, as the wave function builds up at a certain point, it gets bigger and bigger, and it acts like its own defect and attracts things. So that's the intrinsic part of intrinsic localized modes. Let me mention one other thing about nonlinearity, because it was something that I did for the children's picnic here on Wednesday, which was really fun. Nonlinear systems, a good example is your heart. It's a nonlinear oscillator. You can take your pulse and feel it beat. But if you're giving a radio program, it's probably beating much faster than normal. But when we turn off the sound, it'll go back to normal. That's basically a periodic oscillator. And what I showed the kids was a chemical oscillator. That is a mixture of chemicals that actually changes color from clear to amber to blue for many, many periods. It goes on as an oscillator for a long time. And now I'll ask you guys a question. Do you think the oscillator, it's just sitting there in a beaker, can go on forever?
No.
Why?
Because there's always a slight loss of energy to something, eventually slowing down the process.
That's basically right. The point is, we're not feeding it anything. Mm-hmm. And so if, for example, you weren't fed for a long time, you would go to a fixed point called death. And that's the same thing with a chemical oscillator. It won't go on forever unless you feed new chemicals into it. That's a good answer.
With the intrinsic localized modes, do you see more of a practical application or more further research into a practical application for it?
There are many possible potential practical applications because these things are very stable. Some nonlinear excitations, things called solitons, which we can go into if you want later, are pretty well restricted to one-dimensional systems, that is, wires and lines. Intrinsic localized modes can exist in any spatial dimension. So one-dimensional, and they can exist in the graphene two-dimensional or in a bulk material that's three-dimensional. And their stability allows them possibly to be used for things like maintaining information, as in the kind of thing you'd want for a quantum computer. So there are potential, clear potential applications. One trick is how you interrogate them, how you interact with them in a way to get the information out from them. But it's still a very ongoing theoretical process. I don't see it as being in your latest iPhone in the next 2 or 3 years.
Do you think you'll actually continue with it to the point where you might be on the team making it practical?
Well, that would be nice. If somebody got a good patent on that, that would be quite valuable. But I don't know. I would say rather than the intrinsic localized modes, I'm working more on the practical aspects of the two-dimensional materials, mm-hmm. where there's some very interesting possible electronic materials that allow you to store information not just in the charges of the electrons, but in their spins, and even in something that's a little bit weird called valleytronics. I think that's probably beyond the scope of what I can explain in 25 words or less, or even a tweet. But there's another degree of freedom which can be used to store information up or down. And the spin, of course, famously, of an electron can be spin up or spin down. If you can stabilize the spin states, you can store information there, just as you do in a regular electron system with charge.
Wow.
That's called spintronics, by the way.
I could revolutionize electronics again.
That's right. That's the hope. The other thing that's nice about these materials, because they're so thin, they're essentially transparent. But they can also be made conducting. So you can have a transparent conducting material, which is extremely useful for a lot of applications. Photoelectric cells, for example, can be revolutionized by making basically sandwiches of these two-dimensional materials each with a specific property to capture the photons from the sun and then convert them to electrons to make electricity. So a lot of work on photoelectric devices in these two-dimensional materials.
It's pretty spectacular just how much these applications really relate to the problems that we're facing right now.
It is. And in fact, I have to say, I started out in theoretical physics in what is called quantum field theory, which actually applies to solid state, but it's more used now in particle physics. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that I moved away from particle physics, which is searching for, quote-unquote, the theory of everything, something like string theory, to solid-state physics was because you had so many more tools, so many more different pieces. If there is a theory of everything, it's just one theory. But if you look at real materials, they have so many different properties that explaining them and understanding them and utilizing them is a much richer field. So that was one of the reasons I moved that way.
When did you actually move towards that field?
My odyssey was really, really very weird, but I guess I can explain it. Mm-hmm. So I, as I said, I got my PhD in Cambridge. I worked on high-energy physics, something called multi-particle production. If you have read any of the Tom Brown books about CERN or anything else, you know that when you bash particles together at very high energies, you get a slew of particles out. And that was called multi-particle production, and I studied that. I continued that work when I was a postdoc at Illinois, and then when I went to be a postdoc at the Institute for Advanced Study, I got involved with a couple of colleagues on a problem in neutron stars related to particle physics. It was called pion condensation. And it was supposed to be a phenomenon that could apply to in a neutron star. I won't go into technical details, but one of my colleagues in that work, Gordon Boehm, is visiting the center right now, and he and I are still talking about that. Anyway, in that work, I found a particular field theory model to describe it. And then that was a full three-dimensional model. But then I realized if I took that model down to one dimension, I could find some localized nonlinear excitations, not intrinsic localized modes, but things called solitons, and I could find them in this simple model. And then I heard a lecture on a conducting polymer called polyacetylene, and I realized that basically the equations I had solved were the same ones for polyacetylene. And so this material, the solid-state material, should have these solitons. And in fact, they do. So it was quite interesting, odyssey from particle physics to astrophysics back to condensed matter physics, excuse me, but with the underlying mathematical structure being the same. And that's actually a very important lesson, that the nature of mathematics in describing the physical world is really remarkable. And there's a brilliant essay by Eugene Wigner in the late 40s called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Physical Sciences. So those of you who are thinking of going on in physics, be sure to take a lot of math.
That's one thing you'll not hear in a high school.
Can you tell us a little bit about your work or research with deterministic chaos?
Yes, I can. Nonlinear phenomena are different from linear phenomena in several ways, the most important one being that because for a nonlinear system, if you have a solution at one place and a solution at another place, you can't add the solutions together. The simple way, high school algebra, if you take the quantity a plus b and you square it, you don't get a squared plus b squared. Mm-hmm. You get a squared plus b squared plus 2ab. And that's in an essence of nonlinearity. Makes it hard to solve problems. An example from Aspen about linear versus nonlinear motion would be a good example would be fly fishing. You're on the fork, a roaring fork, and you're in a region where it's very smooth and flowing, no rocks or anything, and you cast your fly, and it lands, and it moves in a very predictable pattern with the current, so predictable that the trout are probably not going to go after it. But if you cast your fly into a little whirlpool where it's spinning around, so it may spin around 5 times or 6 times or 10 times and then suddenly spit out behind a rock, that's the sort of unpredictability of nonlinear motion. And it's also a better way to catch a trout. So chaos is the very strange idea that even in Newtonian physics, where we know all the laws of physics and all the forces acting on things, if you start in a chaotic system, if you start to start an experiment where two things are very close together, over time they can become, they separate and become very different, and they go to completely different histories. So a sensitive dependence on initial condition leads to widely different results. And that's basically the surprising origin of chaos.
In these cases where they just separate and differ quite greatly, can you actually pinpoint why it did it? Or is it more a mystery of how it causes the chaos?
It's not a mystery in the sense that you can describe it mathematically. Intuitively, it was very, very surprising. But actually, Henri Poincaré, at the beginning of the 20th century, realized that. And he has a great quote which says something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing, a small cause which escapes our notice becomes an enormous effect. Mm-hmm. And we say the system is probabilistic. He used that word instead of chaotic. But that was the origin. He recognized it, but he couldn't do much with it, because you cannot solve these chaotic problems analytically in general. You need the computer. And so if you look at the history of chaos, and in general, there were some developments after Poincaré and formal developments, but it really was with the rise of computers that led to the understanding of chaos. And perhaps the most famous example of that was by a meteorologist named Ed Lorenz from MIT, who was doing simulations of the weather, which is very famously unpredictable. In fact, Poincaré described the weather as an example of a chaotic system, although he didn't use that word. So Lorenz was doing a numerical study of a model for weather. He stopped the study at one stage. He was carrying a certain number of integers bits in the computer, but he only printed out 5 bits on his piece of paper. He started with the same 5 bits the next day, and the solution was completely different from the solution he had the day before. The reason being that the bits that he didn't put in were affected the motion. That's that tiny difference in the initial conditions led to a huge difference in display. He was one of the real pioneers in discovering deterministic chaos. It's not random. You're not cheating by putting in stochasticity. It's the system itself produces this unpredictable behavior over long times. There's a good book that gives a history of what's going on some years ago by James Glick, the New York Times writer, called Chaos, The Making of a New Science. Mm-hmm. And that's something which anyone can read. It's more about the people involved than the actual mathematics, but it's also very readable.
How do you really expect chaos to affect the other branches of science, not just theoretical physics, but the practical applications of it, maybe even biology or chemistry?
That's an excellent question. So the question is, can you have chaotic motion in biology or other systems? The answer is yes. Typically, chaos is very sensitive, so it can be easily masked by other effects. But there's an argument still ongoing that the human heart, we talked about the regular beating of the heart as being not quite periodic, but variable depending on stress. Various heart arrhythmias, so atrial fibrillations, other Venckebach oscillations, which are a 4-to-3 beat between the two nodes of the heart. It was thought for a while that you could actually have chaos in some heart pathologies, but that's not really held up. So chaos is more, you have to be aware of the possibility that a system that seems to be random is actually fundamentally deterministic. And so that's applied. There are examples in engineering. There are examples in coding theory. Basically, it's a paradigm, is one way of saying it, that you have to be aware of in any scientific or engineering discipline where nonlinearity plays a role. If you have nonlinearity in a particular way, you can get this chaotic behavior. For example, you might want chaos sometimes. If you're having some mechanical motion where you don't want to have a pounding on a certain point all the time, you want to have it be aperiodic and be chaotic And so it's not regular, so it doesn't damage the part you're dealing with by being pounded on.
I have no words right now.
Is there any way to minimize this chaotic behavior in experiments or in your research?
Absolutely, yes. And when you have nonlinear equations, there are usually coefficients in them called parameters. Mm. And chaos only occurs in certain parameter regimes. And you can know how to eliminate it by staying out of those parameter regimes.
I'm fascinated by how much these two young men delved into your research and knew what to ask and how to ask it and listened to the answers. And I hope our audience did too. So thank you. David Campbell is from Boston University, and Will Kaufman and Matt Popish are rising seniors from, respectively, Glenwood Springs High School and Aspen High School.